Good morning. It's good to be here with you. Before I say anything else, I do want to say thank you to Pastor Brian. I mean, I know he's not here. I mean, his body's not here. It's down south. Apparently, his head is still here, but his body's down south. I want to say thanks to Pastor Brian and Pastor Blake and Matt DePrez for, as Brian intimated, for their kind embrace of us, my family, when we came to Frontline a few years ago. We were in a particularly bad shape. And what we found at Frontline, and I hope it's your experience as well, we found a warm welcome. We found the embrace that we needed. We found the space to heal up and become ourselves again. And so I'm standing here this morning in part because Brian has kind of over the last few years nursed this along until finally asking me. So he says, are you ready to kind of get off the bench and get back in the game a little bit? We have some needs. I said, well, okay, I guess that's what everybody does, isn't it? The music people, the kids people, the usher, everybody. Where's the hole? Okay, I'll go stand there and plug that hole, right? So I said, okay, what do you need me to do? And he said, I mean, it wasn't exactly this way, but this was the net effect of it. He says, well, we're going to do a series on depression. Oh, okay, thanks. I was kind of hoping for something simple, you know, like sovereignty versus free will. Maybe a nice message on tithing. Everybody likes that. We just did. Maybe something political. I was hoping for something easy. No, depression. Overwhelmed. See, the irony of it is that I actually left teaching and pastoral work a number of years ago after a 10-month battle with clinical depression, which by any accounts, I lost spectacularly. And so this sermon today is uncomfortably autobiographical, and I don't like it. But at least we'll all go down together. So once again, thanks. Thanks, Brian. Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. As Brian said, this is going to be a 4-week series from the life of one of God's servants who met with despair, the prophet Elijah. And in a few minutes, we're going to meet him cowering in a cave in the side of a mountain, praying for death. Yes, it's going to be one of those kinds of sermons. Sorry. But in a moment, first of all, I'd like it to clarify a bit this idea, overwhelmed, because it can mean a lot of things in a lot of different contexts. I mean, perhaps the most obvious use of the word is the image on the screen. You're standing at the foot of a mountain that you have to climb. You're looking up at it, and you're thinking to yourself, huh? How? So many steps. Where do I begin? I can't get started on something like this. Perhaps it's the reason why you've never written that great American novel that you know it's in there. Because the idea of putting 60, 80,000 words onto paper, where do you begin? How do you start something like that? Maybe it's the reason you've never gotten out of credit card debt. You look at the statements. It's too big. There's no bite-sized chunk. There is no smallest bill. I don't know how to begin. Perhaps it's why you chose not to marry or remarry or have children or start your own business or travel to Europe or end that abusive friendship. Because the process of doing it is overwhelming. I just don't know how to start. There's all kinds of things in life we don't risk or attempt because on the front end they feel overwhelming. Well, then overwhelmed can simply be a synonym for stressed. Right? Too many things to do, not enough time. All those reports that are due on Tuesday, those exams that you have to take. There's no way to get prepared. You can't get them done. There's not enough time. Tell me how much time I have and I'll tell you what I'm not going to get done. Maybe it's those 3 kids that somehow, by some mystery, have to be dropped off in four locations at the same time. I mean, how does that work? And yet, it's my life every week. I don't want to minimize these kinds of overwhelmedness. Overwhelmed. I think I made up a word. Oh, I'm terribly sorry. I don't know how that translates into sign language. Okay, we're good. She wasn't there the first service. And I apologize for everything that's coming. Now, I don't want to minimize this kind of overwhelmed sense. This kind of stuff is awful. It's miserable. And if you're feeling overwhelmed in any of these ways, don't fret. These series of 4 weeks, most everything that's said will be beneficial to you. But Elijah is not overwhelmed in any of these ways. See, there's actually a kind of overwhelming that is far worse, deadly even. See, here's Elijah's story, or just a bit of it. You'll get the rest in a minute, but Elijah received a message. He opened up his email one day, bing, there it was, a death threat, cyber bullied of his day. You're going to die, and I'm going to take you out. And understandably, he is freaked out by this. In fact, here's his response. Elijah was afraid and ran for his life. When he came to Beersheba in Judah, he left his servant there while he himself went a full day's journey out into the wilderness, and he came to a bulrush, a shrubbery, sat down under it, and prayed that he might die. I've had enough, Lord, he said. Take my life. I'm no better than my ancestors. Do you hear it? This isn't stress. This is despair. Now, if you know anything about Elijah's story, the response seems too big, too much, unexpected. You see, Elijah was a prophet in Israel. And the prophets in Israel were not generally, I mean, it wasn't a career that came with a lot of accolades. The prophets in Israel were generally a pretty troubled lot. I mean, if you pick up and read any of those books in the middle of the Bible that we seldom read, but are named after all the prophets, you know, Obadiah, Jonah, Micah, Nahum, Habakkuk, all of those guys, what you'll discover quickly is that the prophet's job more or less consisted of saying really, really awful things, really unpopular things, and then being oppressed. That was kind of how it worked. They were, on their best days, simply ignored. More often, they were threatened, imprisoned, and even frequently killed. It's not exactly the future you would hope for your little boy. What do you want to be, Johnny, when you grow up? Oh, I want to be a prophet. I don't know why your son is Irish. It's your kid. You figure it out. Well, this is where Elijah was different. See, he was actually a pretty successful prophet. He actually was on his game. He had lots of successes happen. In the chapter immediately before that, in 1 Kings 18, he had just come through a kind of Iron Chef sort of challenge with a whole bunch of other prophets and came out on top. They all got chopped, kind of literally in their case. See, what they had done was they'd set up two altars over on Mount Carmel, because they wanted to see who was really the greatest God in Israel. So on the over here, you know, in the left corner in the red trunks, was the local pagan fertility god, Baal, or as he was sometimes slurred, Baal-zebub, the lord of the flies. Flies, of course, being very fertile, you know. So here he's out here, and he's got his retinue of 400 prophets. I mean, think about it. Look around you. 400. That's a pretty good estimation. Okay? That's a lot of people. Over here in the right-hand corner in the blue and white trunks is the old covenant God of Israel, Yahweh, and his retinue of Elijah. So which one of these was going to be the case? The goal was to see which of these gods would send down fire from heaven and consume the sacrifice. So the prophets of Baal got the first turn, and they spent about 8 hours doing their thing. They jumped and they sang and they shouted and they cut themselves and did all this kind of stuff to get Baal to respond and do his thing. And Elijah sort of mocks them off to the side. Maybe he's asleep. Maybe he's checking Facebook. Maybe he's not around. He's busy. And so they do all of this, and the Lord of the Flies is silent. The only thing the altar actually attracts is flies. But then it's Elijah's turn. And he gets down on his knees, and he prays a prayer that, in essence, says this. And I want you to pay attention to this, because this will tell you what Elijah really knows in his head for later on. What does he really know? He gets down on his knees, and he says, "Well, God, I came. I did what I was supposed to. There it is. Now you're going to have to take it. You have to act. You have to show yourself to be God. I can't change the hearts of these people. You be God, and you do your thing." Boom! Fire from heaven comes down, consumes the sacrifice, the wood on the altar. The very stones of the altar itself are consumed, and people jump back. Whoa! That's what it actually is in the original Hebrew. It says, whoa! The people get the point. They turn on the prophets of Baal, the 400 of them, and they chase them down to the river, and they slay them all to a man. The nation returns to the God of its forefathers. Yay! And it's Elijah's in a great spot. This is all good, right? Sauron defeated, the ring cast into the volcano, the eagles finally show up. Except for the fact that Baal is still the favored god of the queen in Israel. And she's a nasty piece of work. Her name, you guessed it, Jezebel. Yeah, that one, and everything it implies. And her husband, King Ahab, is no better. I mean, his name was only fit for being impaled on a white whale in a Herman Melville novel. Again, sorry. So they're actually they're kind of the Bonnie and Clyde of the Old Testament, except they're the ones who are about to do the hunting. It is Jezebel that sends him this message. She says, "May the gods deal with me, be it ever so severely, if by this time tomorrow I do not make your life like one of them." Okay, this is how bad she is. She doesn't just send a swordsman, you know, "Go kill Elijah." "Yes, ma'am." No, that's not how she does it. She's truly evil. Like any good villain, she monologues. She sends a messenger and says, "Elijah, I'm going to kill you. Not now. Later. You don't know when. Sometime in the next day, you're going to be walking down the bread aisle at Meijer, and somebody's going to sneak up behind you and put a shiv in your gut." That's Jezebel. And here in the face of Elijah's greatest victory in his life, maybe the greatest victory any Israelite prophet ever had, he's looked death in the face and walked away clean. But now he's faced with a mere threat on a vaguely defined timetable. And he loses hope and bolts. The story here, I think, is a textbook illustration of a very important principle in life that if you've not figured it out, you will. We are often more susceptible to despair after the victory than before the battle. We're often more set up for failure after we've done the great thing. I mean, think about it. The expectant mother, 8.5 months,
"Get this thing out of me."
She's expectant. That's what the word means. She's hopeful. Yes, it's a big, there's a mountain here to climb. I've got to give birth. Well, your children present, you know, giving birth consists of. Oh, this big task she's got to do. It is not the expectant mother that experiences depression. Who is it? We have a term for it. Postpartum depression. It's after she's gone over the mountain and is now entering into the valley of new responsibilities on the other side. Her strength has been exhausted. She put everything her had into it. The adrenaline has flowed away, and yet she is still faced with that new journey just beginning, and she doesn't feel like she has any more resources. That's when she's susceptible. In the face of her greatest success, when she feels like a complete failure. See, the resources to climb the mountain are already there. All that requires is a little courage, a little putting one foot in front of the other, a little adrenaline, some pumping music, and you can get over the hill. But what about the darkness of the valley on the other side? See, Elijah has just won a great victory, a draining victory, and now the adrenaline is gone, his resources are spent, and he has not apparently realized that life does not wait for you to recoup before it sends the next crisis. And he doesn't know what to do. So he runs. Now, it's abbreviated for time a bit, but there's an angel that shows up there as he's sitting by the brook and says, "Get up, get up, get up. Eat. This journey you're about to take is too much for you." So he gets up, he eats, he drinks, and strengthened by that magical food, he travels 40 days and 40 nights. Now, by my math, that's longer than a month. Until he reaches Horeb, the mountain of God, and there he goes into a cave and spends the night. Now, lots of really smart Old Testament studies people believe that Horeb is actually, or may actually be, Mount Sinai, which, if you'll recall, a couple of hundred years earlier was the place that God showed up with fire and thunder and power and lightning and all of that and gave the Ten Commandments to Moses. Entered into covenant with the children of Israel, made them the chosen people. That's the spot he runs to. Apparently, Elijah is so desperate for help that he doesn't believe that God can meet him where he actually is in the midst of the next new challenge. He thinks he's got to go find God in some place of previous glory. That for this to work, he's got to somehow relive some glorious past rather than face the new crisis that's in front of him. So he runs to the last place God was, expecting what? I don't know. God to do another thing? New set of commandments? Now you'll see in coming weeks with Pastor Brian that God is good. And God does meet him there. But this week we're just setting up the problem. So you got to come back. Sorry. It's a to be continued. Why does Elijah do this? You see, every person Elijah could meet upon the road, anywhere in Israel, who'd heard of what happened at Mount Carmel, would be saying to Elijah, "Why are you running?" We, the readers of the story, are a bit mystified by it. Why is he running? Did he not remember what just happened? In fact, he gets into this cave, and God here shows up, and God even says, kind of tongue-in-cheek, it's almost funny, Yahweh comes to him and says, "Elijah, what are you doing here?" It's like, did you not realize that I could have met you where you were by the stream? But Elijah takes the question at face value and pours out this litany of despair. "I have been very zealous for Yahweh, God Almighty." Right? You know that? "But the Israelites have rejected your covenant. They've torn down your altars. They've put your prophets to death with the sword, and I am the only one left. Now they're trying to do me in too." Now, if you've been tracking with me so far in the story, you know that's not exactly precisely true. At the very least, it ignores all the great stuff that we just saw happen. Elijah's offering a set of alternative facts. I didn't make up the word. But his blindness, the blindness that he has to his own actual situation around him, is what leads most readers to actually identify a real, genuine, almost diagnosable depression. He can no longer see what anyone else around him could tell him was the case. He can't believe it. His is the cry of a soul walking in darkness. "I am alone." Now, at this point of the story, I was struck by the familiarity of Elijah's words. It is a faithful depiction of the journey into darkness that is depression. And I reflected upon my own time in it, and how many people gave me books? Oh, a dozen books if it was one. Just to give you a hint, depressed people don't read books. It's way too much work. Too many words. And I went from reading 50 books a year as part of my discipline, part of what I did, and in 10 months I read one. Jerry Seitzer, A Grace Disguised. It's a good book. Jerry Seitzer, back in the 90s, he lost 3 members of his family, his mother, his wife, and his daughter in the same car accident, and he was driving. It wasn't his fault, but at that point, who cares? He describes his journey. It's exactly Elijah, how he muscles through all of those initial responsibilities, you know, the funerals and the arrangements and the finances and what to do with the rest of his kids and all of that, and he gets it through, and then what's waiting for him on the other side? The silence of an empty life. He describes it. Oh, grief, I did this in first service. I'm old enough now, I can't read this. I'm going to have to go here. It's from this book. I'll look at the big text on my screen. I found depression completely debilitating. It took Herculean strength for me to get out of bed in the morning. I was fatigued all day long, yet at night I was sleepless. I would lie awake by the hour feeling the torment of a darkness that no one else could see but me. I had trouble concentrating. I was apathetic and desireless. I could not taste food, see beauty, touch anything with pleasure. And I exacerbated the problem by telling virtually no one about my struggle. Friends and colleagues marveled at how well I was doing, but inside I was a living dead man. Do you hear the common thread? Unable to speak, unable to see, unable to hear, unable to feel, unable to respond to life like a living thing. Oh, the gears keep clicking, they keep turning through the day's activities, but not like a living man, a mere automaton running, running, running for 40 days and nights. But no life in you. I stood in front of a congregation very much like this for 10 solid months and preached a sermon every single week. Said some really good stuff. And on the inside, I was dead. But the gears keep clicking. No longer a man, you're a machine. And once you felt it, you can recognize it in others. I remember sitting across from a friend much later. Nice guy, lovely wife, beautiful children, good job, nice house. And he sat there so horribly familiar with those sunken, hollow eyes, saying to me, Jeremy, I wake up every morning wondering how I managed to get the life I have. And I wanted to grab him, shake him, like so many people tried to shake me. And tell him, no, your life is beautiful. You have so much good. You know how many people would kill for your life? And you can tell he can't hear. He can't see. He doesn't know. It's all darkness. It's like telling a blind man how beautiful the picture on the wall is. He just can't see it. Understand, if you've never had this thought, you just need to bank this and know it. Depression destroys your ability to see and hear truth. The whole of the internal life is turned inward and consumed by a silent scream that never needs to pause for breath. If you've ever been in Elisha's place, you know exactly what I'm talking about. So, of course, that raises the question, what do you do for such a person? Because I know the people in this room here today, you're living with that person. That person's in your family. It's your kid. It's your spouse. It's your parent. It's your neighbor. It's your friend. It's your coworker. And you're watching them die from the inside out. What do you do for them? Well, I want to talk to you people for a minute before turning my attention to the more problematic question. The first thing I want you to understand, the only thing I want you to understand is comfort. It's not your fault that they can't hear you. It doesn't mean you're doing anything wrong. It may have nothing to do with you at all. The blind man cannot see the painting, not because you're not describing it well. It's simply the definition of what it means to be blind. It comes with the territory. Now, that doesn't mean you shouldn't speak. It doesn't mean you shouldn't try to call them back to the light. Yes, sometimes we have to say hard, true things to people that we know aren't listening yet. It's called parenting. If you only talk to your kids when they're listening, your house would be a quiet place. I'm talking, you're not listening. Sorry, there's a bit of my own baggage there. But once you've exhausted yourself trying to pull that person that you love so much, forgive me, I think I seem to have caught a cold in the last 30 seconds. When you are wearied from trying to pull the person you love out of that dark place with no success, I would offer to you, you have actually experienced a very powerful spiritual truth at work, a truth that if you will embrace it, can actually give you some peace, some rest, and even some hope in the midst of your struggle. And it is this. Only God can reach the human heart. And that's always the case, but you feel it more when you're dealing with a person in despair. See, God alone knows what pressures are necessary. God alone knows the shape of the lock on the soul and the shape of the key that matches it. God knew what the bottom looked like for me. It's not something you could have predicted. I couldn't predict it. I didn't know it myself. But when God did it, it was like handwriting on the wall. It was the perfectly shaped key to the lock I couldn't even see, and everything broke and shattered. And I was myself again. In a period of hours, days. No one could have known that but God. See, unlike Jezebel, God doesn't send messengers to Elijah with words he cannot hear. God comes to meet Elijah in the mountain with exactly, and only God knows what Elijah needs. You got to come back next week to find out what that is. For now, I want to try to help you, the person who is struggling with, trying to live with, or help the person in despair. And your lesson today is this. If you've said and done everything you can think of to do and say, and it has had no effect, that is okay. You never had the power to save them anyways. They were not yours to save. People are not there so that we can do things to them. They belong to God, and they are taking a journey with God that God alone knows. They themselves don't even know because they walk in darkness. So yes, grieve with them, be present with them, speak truth in love, keep doing all the things you're doing, but then do this. Give them back to God. Because only their Creator knows them well enough to reach into that place where they dwell and shine light on the dark places. I hate to surprise you or shock you with this. If no one's ever told you, I'm sorry to upset your case, but you are not the light of the world. You do not have the power to raise dead men to life. God alone has that kind of power, and as you will see in the coming weeks, with Elijah, God is still very much in the business of raising the dead. With this God, dead men do tell their tales. Do you need proof? However, As I said, the real target of this sermon is you, and you know who you are. You're the person today who finds themselves walking in the dark, and I have some things to say to you, even if you can't hear me. A couple of observations in closing to prepare you for the stuff that Brian's got coming in the next week. Because God is not done here talking to Elijah, and God is not done talking to you either. And I, this morning, would like to speak against the isolation that you feel. I would like to try to speak truth against the lie that your soul is telling you. I am all alone. See, it's probably not true. You are probably not as alone as you think you are. There are probably, if you feel alone, it is what it is. But there are probably people in your life who are trying desperately to love you. Family, friends, coworkers, people who are trying, but I understand you can't see them. You can't hear it. It's not there. It's all a buzz. But I want you to know it is probably the case. The solitude and isolation you feel is probably a lie. I had lots of people. Denise, my wife, my kids, all were trying to love me desperately. People of the church, there were many people. Some people who knew who were trying, who tried. Many who didn't, however. Hundreds who may have been potential allies to me in my darkness, but I was afraid to tell them. Christians, pastors, theologians are not supposed to lose hope. It's not allowed. And so I was afraid. And I was ashamed of a journey that in many ways I could not help. It was my journey. And I would like to encourage you to think about your life. Maybe answer this. Fill in the blank in this statement. I know no one cares, and I know I'm all alone, and this is all hypothetical, but see how far I'm coming? I'm trying to... Oh, with all of that, but if there was anyone in my life who did care, it would probably be... Whose name did you just put in that blank? That's a great place to start. Try telling them and see what happens. But yes, I know, we are an isolated culture. We don't do well at living life together. And it is possible that you walked in here today without friends or family, and you really are alone. Well, I would like to tell you something as well. You do not need to be as alone as you are. Think about where you are. You walked into the kingdom of God this morning. You've walked into this family. There are people here who don't want to fix you. They don't want to preach at you. They don't want to tinker with you. They want to sit on the ash heap with you. They want to be there. There are people sitting around you. You may not even know them yet. You can meet them after the service by going to the banners in the back. There'll be people there waiting. Go to the orange wall, meet someone. We have small groups here, little collections of people to get together and do fun things and live life together and that sort of thing. You would be welcome. I'm sure many, all of them would be willing to just let you come and hang. Sit in the background if you want. Be silent. That's okay. You're welcome in mine. We meet on Sunday nights here over in a classroom. You'd hate it. It's kind of a classroom because I'm trying to do teaching things because that's all I know how to do. And so it's not warm and fuzzy, but if the alternative is a sitting alone at home, I mean, if the people in your life are really just coworkers and cats, and neither of which care about your long-term survival, come be with us. I know, I'm asking you to take a step. A hard step, a step that you feel is pointless and without benefit. Okay, I'll meet you again. To the one today then who, yes, hates your solitude, but cannot find the internal strength to break it by speaking, I have one other thing to say. It won't change your situation, but I hope it will give you some space and some time to get you back here next week for the next chapter of the story. I'd like you to listen to a quotation, look at a quotation up here, and I'd like you to think about what kind of person would say this. Is it you? Lord, my God, who am I that you should forsake me, the child of your love, and now become the most hated one, the one you have thrown away as unwanted, unloved, I call, I cling, I want. There is no one to answer. No one on whom I can cling. No, no one. Alone. Where is my faith? Even deep down, right in there, is nothing but emptiness and darkness. My God, how painful is this unknown pain? I have no faith. I dare not utter the words and thoughts that crowd in my heart and make me suffer untold agonies. Now, think to yourself, what sort of bedridden person? So a person all used up with nothing more to give or contribute would reach a point where they cry out such a cry. I'm glad you asked. You know who it was? No less than one of the most potent, effective, and powerful Christians of the 20th century, who spent long tracts of her life in spiritual darkness. I want you to understand something. You've heard it from Elijah. You've heard it from Jerry Seitzer, Dr. Jerry Seitzer. You've heard it from Mother Teresa. You are not alone. You cannot be alone. Christians for ages have been where you're at. They've seen it. This is not unusual. You have not been lost. You haven't taken some wrong turn. This journey that you're on, and I could give you a dozen more voices in the history of the church who've written on it, St. John of the Cross, Thomas a Kempis, Brother Lawrence, Thomas Merton, Henry Nouwen, Charles Spurgeon, I could go on and on and on, of Christians who have walked in the dark and done amazing things. Isaiah himself says, you are the God who hides yourself. If you get nothing else out of this, get this. The whole church surrounds you today. They cry out to you from their desert caves, from their monasteries and sick beds, from the ghettos and the forgotten places of the world. Their hands reach out to you to hold yours in the darkness, to dry the sweat from your brow, and to say to you, we know. We know. We understand. The darkness is real. But you are not alone. And this is not the end. So great a cloud of witnesses testifies to you that this dark journey that you are on, and it is a journey, it will start and it will end, this journey that you're on is common. It is survivable. It is pregnant with possible glory. Do not forget, our Lord himself once lay upon his face in the darkness of a garden, with tears in his eyes, asked his Father, is this really the way you will do this? Is this really how you will do your work in the world? And the silence answered back, yes. Yes, it is. By means of the great darkness of a cross and the great silence of a tomb, I will save the world. You'll remember Jesus' response to that because it makes all the difference. So be it. Do you hear the exhalation? Do you hear the rest? Do you hear the release, the trust? And there is the key. Many precious things grow only in dark places. Who am I kidding? I still can't read this. Jerry Seitzer, a little further down the line, and I close with this. Though I experienced death, I also experienced life in ways I never thought possible before. Not after the darkness, as we might suppose, but in it. I did not go through the pain and come out the other side. Instead, I lived in it and found within that pain the grace to survive and eventually grow. I did not get over the loss of my loved ones. Rather, I absorbed the loss into my life like soil receives decaying matter until it became part of who I am. Sorrow took up permanent residence in my soul and enlarged it. I learned gradually that the deeper we plunge into suffering, the deeper we can enter into a new and different life. A life no worse than before, and sometimes better. A willingness to face the loss and enter into the darkness is the first step we must take. The willingness to face the loss and enter into the darkness is the first step we must take. Like all steps, it is probably the most difficult and takes the most time. The shortest way to mourning, my friends, is always into the darkness. So give yourself the time needed for the journey. Let the dark do its soul expanding work. Wait. Rest. Sleep. Breathe. That's plenty of work for now. For all his solitude and blindness, Elijah there in his cave, he's not alone. And neither are you.